People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. On today's program, we're going to hear from a pair of authors and researchers who've taken a critical lens to some parts of the culture around autism. Patty Douglas writes that she is the mother of a son who has attracted the label of autism. She explores the narratives around motherhood and autism over the years, with mothers often getting blame. From the cold refrigerator mother who was seen as a potential cause of autism in the 1950s, to the idea of the warrior mother who is expected to be hypervigilant in a constant battle against autism. In her book, Unmothering Autism, Douglas questioned those narratives and how their legacy impacts the culture around autism today. We'll hear from her later on in today's program. But first, Julia Grusin Wood explores the culture around a treatment that's garnered controversy. Applied Behavior Analysis, or ABA, is one of the most common interventions for autistic children. Some autistic people with experience of it and advocacy groups describe it as harmful. The Autism Self-Advocacy Network, for example, writes that ABA aims to train autistic people to act non-autistic, and that it and other therapies with the same goals can hurt autistic people and don't teach the skills autistic people actually need to navigate the world with their disabilities. Around 10 years ago, Grusin Wood put out a research call and spoke with a number of people who provided ABA. She says many of the conversations were cagey at first, with people trying to suss out what her angle was. Eventually, some people working in the field shared criticisms of it with Grusin Wood, but they also shared that they felt they couldn't express those concerns publicly for fear of being blacklisted. That inspired Grusin Wood to dig a little deeper. That work led to the forthcoming book, Autism and the Culture of Therapy. I spoke about it with Julia Grusin Wood.
My name is Julia Grusin Wood. I am a social studies of health researcher. I'm an adjunct professor at University of Guelph, and I work at the University of Toronto as a research partnerships officer.
And we are going to be talking about a book you have written. It is called Autism and the Culture of Therapy. And I think an important place to start this conversation is trying to define or at least provide some context around a definition of what people understand when they say the word autism.
Ooh, that's a big one. And I would say that autism has been many things over many periods of time, and it remains to be so. You know, autism began like in the 1910s to the 1940s-ish as being sort of considered a symptom of this broader definition called childhood schizophrenia. It moved to being seen as this sort of psychogenic disorder, quote unquote, by people like Bettelheim and the likes, who, you know, blamed cold refrigerator mothers primarily for giving their children autism. And then there was the behavioral turn in the 60s and 70s, which is really my focus of the sort of what happened to the behavioral turn. And this is the idea that autism is a set of behaviors that can be modified. And then, of course, in the 1990s, there's this huge, powerful neurodiversity movement led by autistic self-advocates and their allies, saying autism is a form of neurological difference, similar to differences like gender, race, class, and actually the struggle to be seen as equal, to be seen as valid, is similar to like another kind of civil rights struggle to be seen as equal and a struggle for justice. And now there's like so many competing ideas of what autism is, and you see this playing out in the public sphere, like even just like very recently, this idea of Tylenol causing autism with like RFK in the States. And obviously, the sort of underlying sense there is autism is a bad thing to be avoided, right? Versus this, really, again, strong neurodiversity movement, which is about autism as a valid form of neurological difference. So autism means many things to many people and probably will continue to be so and continue to evolve for many years to come.
On that front, maybe I'll just share what the Health Canada page says about autism, and maybe ask you, as a researcher who's been focusing on this topic for years, if there's any context you'd provide around that. So here's what it says on the website. It says, autism, also known as autism spectrum disorder, or ASD, is a lifelong neurodevelopmental condition. Autistic people may communicate and connect with other people differently, have sensory processing differences, focus intensely on certain interests and activities. Autistic people may also have other physical, intellectual, learning, or mental health conditions, which can introduce complexities and challenges. Everyone has different experiences and characteristics, so the type and extent of supports should adapt to individual needs. So that there's more to the page, but that is kind of the beginning of the Health Canada definition of autism. Anything you think people need to know as extra context around that?
It's not that I agree or disagree. Like, it's as a social scientist, primarily from an anthropological perspective, my approach to autism is to understand the social meanings of autism, where they sit in where these meanings sit in culture, and how these meanings shift over time. And so, yeah, I mean, that seems to me like the def one of a social understanding of autism right now, and maps on to how autism is diagnosed, how self-diagnosis happens, and the key kind of characteristics of what autism is today.
And in your work, you have focused on the titular culture of therapy. To really understand what you were talking about, we're going to have to understand what ABA, applied behavior analysis, is. I understand this is kind of the thing in the world of treatment, if it's fair to say, for autism.
Yeah, totally. It's like the primary intervention. Still, I would say definitely, at the time of, so my, I'll just say most of my research on autism and the book that we're talking about today, it comprises field work that I did from 2014 to 2016. And so what I've done is a recent history of autism and behavioral therapies. And at the time of writing, behavioral therapies had exploded. They were huge. They were definitely the primary therapy being funded by our Ontario government. There was this huge push and struggle for professionalization. And so, yes, so these therapies were burgeoning in the early 2000s, the late 1990s even, and then became a dominant model.
What is ABA, applied behavioral analysis, and like what is kind of the space it takes up in the autism world?
Yeah. Okay. So applied behavioral analysis, it's hard to really do justice to what this is without getting super jargony. So I'm going to try my best not to get super jargony. Applied behavioral analysis, it is a kind of radical behaviorism, which is the idea that behaviors are modified through your environment, through things called antecedents and consequences. Antecedents is what happens before a behavior. Consequence is what happens after a behavior. And so who we are as humans, in the world of applied behavioral analysis is not deep. Like, psychology is deep, right? It's like mining your inner thoughts and like talk therapy and your subconscious. Behavioral therapy is like, what is your environment? And not to say it's not complex, it's very complex. What is your environment? What happened right before you had that behavior? Like, for example, running home. Okay, I ran home one day because it was raining outside. The rain was my environment, and the running was my reaction to the rain that came down. And so, really, applied behavioral analysis is about understanding, charting, and graphing the antecedents and behaviors that can, antecedents and consequences that result in certain behaviors, and then modifying the environment in order to change the behaviors. And the modification often happens through repetition, through data tracking, and through getting lots of people involved and on board so that there's consistency in people's environment. So if you wanted somebody to learn to brush their teeth, you might set up a toothbrush to the right and give a prompt. Okay, put the toothbrush on now. Okay, brushing their teeth. Okay, put on the faucet to take the toothpaste off, and they'll put it back where it belongs. And then going through that again and again and again and again to make sure that the learning of brushing your teeth has been successful.
And could you tell me, how does this come into an intervention for autism?
Well, it came in to an intervention for autism through somebody called Ole Ivar Lovaas. He was an American-Norwegian clinical psychologist in the 60s. He started the Lovaas Clinic at UCLA. He started the first ABA clinic with autistic kids, but also with quote-unquote gender deviant children as well. So there was kind of these parallel populations that he was testing this out with. And he did an intensive version of applied behavioral analysis called early intensive behavior intervention, which involved a sort of total immersive therapeutic environment for the child undergoing these therapies. And that meant that enter like sort of enter scene parents becoming therapists. And so they would suddenly have to apply these therapies in the home. And Lovaas thought parents were essential because that's the only way you could possibly have this total and immersive environment for autistic kids to learn these behaviors. And as he said, I think he said approximate the normal citizen after that. Those were his kind of wild claims about his therapy. So that's how it began.
Could you give me a sense of how someone gets involved with some kind of diagnosis or treatment or intervention for autism and when that is happening in someone's life?
Well, that also has changed over time, but I would say like right now, probably one of the primary places would be like a public school, and a teacher noticing a child has different needs within the classroom and having something called an individualized education plan, and perhaps telling the parents, hey, you might want to get an assessment. And then you go to like a psychometrist or, a sort of diagnostic clinic. They would go through a bunch of tests. And then you would be labeled or not labeled as having being on, now it would be ASD, autism spectrum disorder.
So let's say that happens. Obviously, everyone is going to be different. Every case that happens is going to be different. That's the whole idea behind this IEP, individualized education plan. But what are some of the next steps that might follow on from that?
Well, it would depend on the quote unquote like severity of the case. And also the age. So if somebody is like diagnosed super young, let's say before the age of 5, they still might be told that there is a rush to get them that what I just was talking about, the early intensive behavior intervention. That's like the kind of like immersive, many, 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 many hours, 40 plus hours a week of ABA. In a total environment to quote unquote catch that early intervention window. These ideas have, I think, started to shift a little bit, but certainly up to about 7 years ago, there was this idea that like before the age of 7, there was this real opportunity to impact the what's often referred to clinically as a severity of autism. So these people would probably be funneled into EIVI. And they might have to be on a wait list. If they're on a wait list for public services, then they, if they can scrounge up the cash, go to a private clinic, pay lots of money for private EIVI. Or If they're classified as having moderate or mild autism, and again, these are all in quotes, these are all the language that is used, not the language I would choose. They would might be suggested to have just ABA, go to a clinic maybe a couple times a week, or maybe have a home intervention where a clinician might or a therapist might come into the house, teach parents how to apply certain key behaviors that they want their child to learn or that would be important for their child to learn, such as teeth brushing, and work with them on like a 6-week ABA program. So it sort of depends on the type of autism diagnosis one receives and the age in which they receive it. If you are an adult being diagnosed with ASD, you might not be funneled into these therapies at all.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. My guest is Julia Grusin-Wood. She's author of the forthcoming book, Autism and the Culture of Therapy. For the book, Grusin-Wood spoke with a number of people in the world of applied behavior analysis, an intervention commonly used with autistic children. Now, when you were doing this fieldwork 10 years ago, you described this world where there was this dominant therapy, and if you wanted to work in the field of helping people with autism, you had to really subscribe to its tenets. And then you talk to a lot of the people who did that, and they would tell you sort of off the record, I have problems X, Y, and Z with this. Or in some cases, like, I really think this is fundamentally flawed and bad. And then on the record, they might be at a conference saying, yeah, this works, as they do their presentation. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Oh my gosh. Well, that's the whole reason I wrote this book is this huge, well, I one of the reasons I wrote this book. There's this huge culture of fear against speaking out again about these therapies. And like I'll begin with a story about myself. So I started out being critical of these therapies because, you know, I'd seen them applied. I have a sibling with autism. I'd seen them applied to her. They were very disturbing, just because of the highly repetitive nature of them and the kind of complete and total nature of them, where there it really takes away the agency of the person from what I saw. So that was my impetus. Anyways, I was like a young doctoral student, just at the proposal phase of my PhD dissertation, and I was in this like fellowship program where there was just like people like me, like just starting out their PhDs, and then we had mentors, and there was a huge like kind of network of mentors, and we all got the opportunity to present our proposal to this network of mentors. Now, every week, maybe one or two mentors would show up, right? When I presented, it was like people had like the mentors had to stand in the room because it was like over capacity in this tiny little room. And they weren't there to support my research. They weren't there to be encouraging. They were there because they were involved in autism. They were involved in ABA, and they were there to completely eviscerate it. They were like, this is biased. This is contaminated. How dare like you be critical of this therapy when it's preventing children from poking their eyes out? Like children aren't going to get the help they need if people speak out. And I was like, as an anthropologist, I was like, this is very interesting. That a very young, like not, I wasn't like so, I wasn't like a teenager, but like somebody just starting out with no power within the discipline, not even a professional within the field, was getting so shut down for this research, for being critical. And that's really what I was like, oh, I need to study this culture more than just this therapy, because what is going on here where you cannot speak against it? And so then when I started talking to my interviewees, I would talk to very established clinicians. And going into the interview, some of the people I had no idea whether they were like proponents or critical of these therapies. I just knew they were big in the field, they were involved in these clinics that offered this therapy. So I wanted to talk to them. And they would be kind of doing this like little dance with me about trying to figure out what my stance was. And then it was only once they realized, like, oh, I'm open to listening to critique, which took, you know, quite a lot of work to get there with people, that they would really open up to be talking with me. But they would, even though my study was completely confidential, I anonymized the location, I anonymized the names, they would often, or one one or two people refused to even talk to me with the recorder on. And they would say to me, like, I have seen horrible things happen with these therapies. I've heard of punishments being used, taste aversives. I've seen trauma happening because, people with autism are sometimes more vulnerable to sensory related trauma. So if you're repeating the same thing over and over again, this can lead to like really traumatic outcomes for people. But they refuse to speak publicly about their views because they would, as one person said, would lose their invitations to the parties. But I actually think they were worried about more than that. And then I would see them speak publicly after, because I would observe all these conferences, and they would appraise the therapies pretty quickly, but they would make a point of saying something that would condone, or that would say, these are valuable, and here's this other thing. But yes, these therapies are very valuable for, young children or for autistic people or what have you. And people would tell me, if you want to work in autism, you have to agree with behavioral therapies. You can't work in this field if you disagree. And I thought that that was very interesting.
We've mentioned a couple of times that this was field work you did, circa 10 years ago. Where do you feel like, do you have an idea of where things might be at now as compared to then?
Yeah, so it's very interesting. When I was doing my study, behavioral therapy was at this sort of very interesting moment where it was really people within the field were struggling to become a regulated profession. And I talked about something called the Board Certified Behavior Analysts. And this was a sort of certification board that was becoming more and more of a tacit requirement for anyone working in the field of autism, and certainly anyone providing ABA. The government would only recommend board-certified therapists, and this was really changing the professional field from being more about floor work and frontline workers, social service workers, to academics. And everybody was talking at the time about how important it was to be regulated. And now it actually has become regulated as of, I think, June of last year. And it has become the Ontario Psychologists and Behavior Analysts Board. And this is very interesting to me because there has been so much work from both sides, the psychology side and the behavior analysis side, to separate themselves from each other. But here they are clumped together in this one regulatory college.
What do people need to understand about what that means?
Government funded. It's government funded, insurable, and also standardized in a way that before there was public and private providers, there's still private providers, but now there's a huge amount of support behind it. Like as there is with psychology, if you work somewhere with a medical plan, you have likely a certain amount of psychologist hours that you can see in a year. Now behavioral therapy is part of that. So it's really a huge government investment in this therapy.
And you've talked already about how, 10 years ago you were speaking with people doing this. They had certain issues with the way behavioral therapy worked, or maybe in some cases just issues with the whole thing altogether. What do you think people need to know about that side of things in light of the whole regulation idea?
I mean, that's a really big question. They need to know so much. Let's see. They need to know that behavioral therapy, as one therapist I talked to said, we're a very convincing bunch because we have all these graphs and data. The big thing about behavioral analysis is they chart and they graph. These therapies chart and graph everything, right? And in a way, that's really good because you can track things, there's quote unquote evidence, but in another way, it can result in, kind of funny numbers, which is like the idea that maybe certain realities are hidden, obscured, passed away because they're overtaken by the representation of these graphs and numbers as real. And so, and it's telling the whole story. So there's lots of things that can happen in these therapies that have been, many have considered harmful. Lots of autistic adults and self-advocates have been really fighting against these therapies for a very, very long time for them to be abolished. Because they're often described as abuse.
What is the evidence in support of some of these therapies?
Yeah, that's like it's really mixed. There's some sort of longer studies that would say, we've tracked it's kind of synthesizing a range of studies over time, saying these are really, really effective. And then there's like, for example, Lovass, he did a study, his big study in 1987, and there was some follow-up with the participants, and like they were not doing so hot afterwards, and like as adults and stuff. And so I would say, almost like any other kind of scientific culture or practice, there's competing evidence claims that prove and disprove the efficacy of this method.
Another thread that came up was the idea that there might be adults out there, autistic adults who say, for example, articulate that they don't think this therapy works or they think this therapy actively harmed them. And you described this catch-22 situation where people who articulated these claims, the response was sort of, well, you're not severely autistic, and so, this is really for the people who are and not you. Can you explain?
Oh yeah, and I mean that's just like to me that's one of the most like infuriating things that I witnessed is just the complete erasure of people's own experiences with these therapies because I mean any group of people receiving a certain therapy or intervention or what have you, regardless of what for, should be important to the people who are providing this therapy. And yeah, so I would see there would be a number of strategies used to discount the perspectives of autistic adults who had received behavioral therapy as a kid or who, as an adult, was speaking out against the potential harms of if I had received this as a kid, I think this would have been real, really bad for me. So yeah, they would be told, well, so if they had these therapies as a kid, they would be told, well, the reason you can even speak right now is because you had these therapies and it gave you the tool to have a voice. So the very fact of you having a voice discounts, shows the effectiveness of these therapies. And that's just like a very disempowering, there's nowhere to go from there for as an autistic adult. Like, no, that's not correct, but like when somebody says that, it takes away your agency. It takes away the fact that you're not just speaking because of these therapies that you received as a child. Other people would be told, well, you have mind blindness. You're autistic. You have mind blindness, which is the idea that you can't empathize with other people. You can't see their realities as different than yours, and you're high functioning. You don't know what it's like to be quote unquote low functioning. You're just speaking for yourself, and you are doing a disservice to kids with low functioning autism. So those were some of the strategies I would see that would be used to discount autistic voices.
When you look at some of the characters who developed some of the major interventions over the years as regards autism, people like Lovass or people like Bettelheim, or just ideas like the fact that a lot of people came out after the fact and said, for example, that Bettelheim had been in a concentration camp during the Second World War, and there was this speculation from people who had experienced the kind of residential treatment he had created that he kind of like replicated some of the things that had been done to him there on the people who live there. And then even in the Lovas case, you know, you talked about how kind of alongside this as an intervention for autism, it was also this sort of problematic gender behaviors in children. It was being used as an intervention for that at the same time. Like, what do you think is the takeaway from some of those developments?
I mean, not to be glib, like, not good. Not good. Like, really, really, really disturbing. You know, your podcast is about like the social determinants of health and health equity, health justice. Like, these therapies were done in a very autocratic, disempowering way. But they started out from this, you know, this old school idea of like the clinician is the expert. And sure, like a lot of healthcare providers and clinicians are experts. But when you're so authoritarian in your practice, and also when you have a view of, you know, their views of autism are so negative, that it resulted in some very, very harmful interventions.
Do you feel like, or if so, like, what is the kind of legacy of any of that in what kind of remains or what those therapies have evolved into?
Yeah. Well, I'll speak specifically of behavioral therapies. Behavior therapies, one of the things that I realized when writing my book is, like, I went into this book critical of the therapies, right? But what I realized is because there's this huge kind of culture within the field of, if you want to provide autism, you can't speak critically of behavioral therapies, and you kind of have to provide them. Like, to be in the autism world, you kind of have to provide behavioral therapies. What this resulted in is like a range of practices that like are being called behavioral therapies that are so far away from what Lovas would call behavior therapies. Like, so many practices are being done in the name of behavioral therapies, but they're not these removed scientific clinical practices. As one of the parent couples that I spoke to who had to provide behavioral therapy to their son described it as, they described it as like a buffet approach where they would like reject most things, but then might include something called like a token economy system for like swearing. Okay, so every time you swear, you have to put money in a jar, but every time someone else swears, you get that money. And then at the end of the week, you get all the cash, you know? And that's how they would provide ABA. And so really, I couldn't see a lot of practices that were a through line that I could say, oh yeah, that's ABA and that's not ABA right now. So I think that's a major difference from when the sort of what they would call the old hardcore Lovasian ABA days. Certainly that still exists, but I wouldn't say that that's like the dominant form of ABA now.
There's also this idea of the gendered nature of the field and a kind of contradiction in the fact that right now the people primarily working in it are women, but it was for the most part, like, the theory behind it, it was all designed and created by men.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's like, it's a very masculine coded method based on like automation, replicability, disinterestedness, and authority. And then you have a mostly female workforce providing these therapies and trying to come to terms with the fact that, you know, I'll give an example. I talked to this one, she was a teenager. She was 18 years old, and she was applying behavioral therapies on a volunteer basis, but very regularly at this clinic. And she was talking about the growing pains of applying ABA and working with this autistic youth who would have these behavioral outbursts. And she said, I had to learn, rather than just being like, it's okay, like, you're going to get through this. She said, I had to go through this this learning curve of knowing that if the goal is behavior functionality, it's not kind of me to give her warmth and empathy in that moment. What is kind is to, and then she straightened her posture, her whole demeanor changed towards me, you know, to enforce the behavior program and to follow the guidelines. And that involves being removed, taking away your kind of relatability for her, at least this was her iteration, and becoming very almost robotic in her responses. And so she kind of had to realign this idea of like, I can only be a nice person by towards the this to my, towards my client if I become this kind of this masculinist figure. And so I really saw that struggle in a lot of people. And then of course there's the fact that almost, you know, many behavioral therapy programs require home therapies by parapractitioners. Parapractitioners, for the most part, are mothers who are unpaid therapists. So there's this huge unpaid economy of behavior therapists that's reliant on mothers. And mothers, you know, I also saw them struggling of like, the way they relate to their child has to be cold, distance, and removed if they want to follow the behavior protocol, which is extraordinarily painful for them as well. So there's a lot going on in terms of gender management when it comes to behavioral therapies.
So you've shared a lot of critiques of behavioral therapy. That was kind of the whole point of your research, was to investigate that and to investigate this culture you suggest exists of you can't criticize it. What do you think are the takeaways for you from this work that you've done, these critiques that people have shared, given the fact that it's this big whole apparatus and there's a whole lot of people working in this field, a whole lot of money being spent on this field? It is out there working ostensibly to help people. What do you think the takeaways are?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, there's a lot of takeaways. I mean, one takeaway I had was like, which I didn't think existed beforehand, but there were some behavioral therapists that I interviewed who I felt were applying the therapies in an emancipatory way. And an example of that would be this one therapist, Natalie, every name I use is a pseudonym, by the way, who talked about seeing her job was to go into adult group homes, which is like another whole realm of behavioral therapy that nobody talks about, is that it is applied to adults as well, increasingly so. But she would talk about how her job was to go into group homes and make sure that behavior plans were being applied correctly in the group homes. And she couldn't believe, in her words, the misapplication of behavioral therapies, behavioral therapy plans in these settings. She talked about this one person who, a PSW, who was using the behavior plan to tell the adult in the setting to stop wearing his Mickey Mouse shirt because it was childish. And she's like, who are we to tell this person what to wear? Like, that person like cannot be applying this. This person has agency. And this is not within the realm of behavioral therapy. And another example she gave was like somebody picking their nose and a behavioral therapy plan being created to stop nose picking. And she's like, why? Is it hurting the client? Do they have a like, is it because there's an underlying medical issue where they have an allergy and they want to pick their nose? Like, it's really not up to us to intervene on somebody's bodily autonomy with these therapies. And so I was like, whoa, this exists? This is like kind of amazing. She kind of used behavioral therapy as a tool against oppressive practices that were being also applied through behavioral therapy. So it almost became this like mirror that everybody used differently depending on how they viewed autism in a way. And so that was one take home. It's like, there's all these different ways and approaches that people are using it. And sometimes I don't think these approaches are terrible. Like, sometimes these people can be using this in an emancipatory way. Like, do not tell this person to stop picking their nose. This is their body, like back off. And then another takeaway is that because there's this push for everybody in the field to apply behavioral therapies, it's kind of lost its meaning. Everything and nothing is kind of behavioral therapy now. And also that our healthcare system relies on a lot of unpaid labor in the form of parent practitioners to keep these therapies going.
is a sense that emerged from your work, I'm maybe doing some inferring here, correct me if I'm wrong, that it kind of felt like for people who had this therapy, it sort of its usefulness depended on so many different factors, and it was kind of like if you happen to get someone who was well suited to work with your particular child and maybe who had a particularly good outlook or way to use this, then it could be a really good and helpful thing. If you got someone who was the opposite of that, it could even be a harmful thing. And it was sort of like a big crapshoot.
100%. Actually, yeah, this one couple that I spoke to, these parents, they talked about how their first encounter with a behavioral therapist was for their son. This therapist came into the house, witnessed this mother give their son an apple. And the therapist said, what are you doing? When you can't just give your son an apple. You have to tell your son that he needs to ask for the apple and say please and cut the apple up into little bits. And every little bit, he has to ask for it again. And she was like, what the expletive? I am never letting this person in my house again. And they were like, thankfully for them, upper middle class, they could like refuse the publicly funded therapist and risk that and seek out another therapist. And they said this therapist, one of the reasons that they were so sold by her is because they talked to the therapist as one of the goals they really wanted for their son was to sit down and eat family dinners with them. And this therapist said, why do you want that? Why do you want your son to sit down if he would rather be walking around? Isn't it just important that he's with you? Like, you kind of need to have a bicultural understanding. Like, he's autistic and you're not, and you might need different things. And they were like, this is the person we want, right? They both had the same exact title, very different approaches. And so I really do think the very thing that behavioral therapy wants to kind of do away with, which is subjectivity, relationships, individuality, is the very thing that makes it is what happens in these therapies on a day-to-day basis. It really is dependent on the provider and the people receiving it and how well they mesh. You know, one more thing, sorry, I want to add to is like another thing that really challenged me during the research process was, you know, I didn't only interview behavioral therapy practitioners to understand the culture. I also interviewed recipients, so autistic adults who had received the therapies. I interviewed some autistic recipients who had also become behavioral therapists. And so I noticed that there's also a multiplicity of perspectives within the autistic self-advocacy world because these people also identified as self-advocates. And so it's very messy to just say, you know, these therapies are awful. They always harm autistic people. And for me as a non-autistic person to say that, when some autistic self-advocates themselves, many, 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 most are against these therapists. But I also don't want to be that voice that erases those autistic voices who are saying, well, actually, like, I kind of like these therapies. They help me in this way, and I'm becoming a provider because. So that's another take home for me, that there's a lot of gray areas.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to the conversation today on this?
Listen to autistic people and what they say. Take what they say seriously. Data isn't the whole story. It's part of the story. It can be an opening to a story. But people who receive, especially interventions, need to be the first people to go to when understanding how to evaluate those interventions.
Julia Grusin-Wood, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you so much for speaking with me and for this great conversation.
Julia Grusin-Wood is author of the forthcoming book, Autism and the Culture of Therapy, from UBC Press.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
From the cold refrigerator mother of the 1950s to the more recent warrior mother, There are a number of stereotypes, archetypes, and narratives surrounding moms and autism. Patty Douglas explores them in the book Unmothering Autism.
I am Dr. Patty Douglas. I'm an associate professor at Queen's University in the Faculty of Education and the chair in student success and wellness there as well. And I am both a neurodivergent individual as well as a mom of two neurodivergent sons, one of whom attracted the label of autism.
And you have written a book that is called Unmothering Autism. Maybe the place to start is, how do you define or how do you think of autism? You say there, a son who had attracted the label of autism. What do you think people need to know about that idea?
Autism was never in our lexicon before about the 1940s, late 1940s. It had appeared within other diagnoses like schizophrenia, but it wasn't a thing. There's always been folks who now fit the description of autism, but autism is a made up category just as much as it is a very real lived experience. And so I use that language, which actually comes from my colleague and dear friend, Catherine Renswick Cole, to kind of signal that, I don't, and we don't in our family, place a final word on that word autism. So autism and our understanding of autism and what is autistic is always emerging. And it could become something else. And the other reason is that when I was a mom, so it's my older son who attracted that label, and he was little, I thought my only thoughts were that he was beautiful. He used to line up cars every day. He used to know every single car in that lineup. Had to happen every day, in addition to all sorts of other things that other kids weren't doing. But I wasn't worried. I wasn't fussed. It was really when he entered the school system that that he started to be flagged and that these labels started to be put on him. And it, in some ways, is a deficit label. It tells you there's something wrong with you. At the same time that it's an identity that I absolutely support and I absolutely honor. So using that language just problematizes the category a little bit. So, it's not a finished thing. We're always learning about being human. And I think for me, especially now with the work I do in collaboration with different Indigenous communities around the world, this is also a colonialist term. It's a medicalized colonialist term that can describe something, but it doesn't describe the whole of human experience. So I just want to put a little flag around that term.
You have explored the ways that motherhood and autism have been tied up historically, continue to be tied up. What are the Cole's notes, if you will, about that idea?
Mothers have always been blamed for when things go wrong, and sometimes given praise when things go right. So, and again, scare quotes around wrong. I've come to understand autism, or what we call autism, as another way of being human. And there's no blame. There's no blame in that. It's the diversity of being human. So mothers have always been blamed for autism, along with all sorts of disabilities. Mothers are tasked with reproducing sort of a workforce that's going to build nations. And when that doesn't happen, when we have a child who has any kind of disability label, the fault is primarily given to mothers. So with autism, the first mother that came along were refrigerator mothers. So that was the idea that you were an inherently cold person, even if you appeared warm. You had something disordered in your ability or mechanism of love, to the point, Bruno Bettelheim talked about very subtle kind of reactions when you're breastfeeding a child could, you know, unfold into rejection, and that child, you know, initiated an autistic withdrawal in that child. So kind of a psychoanalytic understanding. And then about when a biomedical understanding of autism became more prominent during the 1960s, 70s, 80s, then all of a sudden mothers were to be sort of the hero therapist. So come, you know, therapies like applied behavior analysis and others being taught to mothers coming into the home, and we were now to be therapists for our children and to normalize them in that sense. And so part of our history as a family was having a behavioral consultant come into our home and, you know, teach us what to do. And so we all took part in this behavioral therapy. And, you know, my kids still laugh about it, and we laugh about it as a family, because it's like, yeah, remember those behavior charts we all had to do? Like, what was that? You're observed, you're scrutinized, you know, and you kind of live in these parallel tracks of you're supposed to be doing one thing. And I was always the mom that would, you were supposed to be learning this therapizing, like this therapy technique, in order to get any service at all at the time. And I didn't have time. I wanted to spend time with my children and enjoy my children. And so I was always the mom showing up late or not having done her homework and getting threatened to get kicked out of the services because I wasn't complying enough. And yeah, anyway, that was the hero therapist. And if your child started to look quote unquote normal, then you were doing well. But if they didn't, then you were blamed for that too, and threatened in terms of losing services, the little services that there were at the time. And then, you know, the most recent sort of iteration of that mother is like the warrior mother. And that's kind of an intensification of that hero therapist kind of mother. So she is now supposed to watch everything from, you know, now we have sort of genomics and epigenetics saying that if I eat the wrong thing or think the wrong thing or live in the wrong place or do anything, have trauma, that's all going to pass down. And I'm going to cause autism, not just in my child, but like in my grandchild now and in my great grandchild. So, you know, she, like, that figure of the warrior mother is also really interesting in some ways, because there's a lot of pushback against medical systems too. So it's complex, but we never get a break, like, which is why I wanted to kind of de-link, you know, the mother part from, you know, the loving and the care and the relationship that you have with your kid.
What do you see as the future of the kind of the neurodiversity movement more broadly, and how it impacts the issues that you've been focusing on in your work?
Yeah. So the neurodiversity movement was started by autistic self-advocates, and it was sort of this collectively started movement. And I think it has great promise. We've got all sorts of rights that have been, you know, fought for and won, as well as different scholarly movements. So, you know, critical neurodiversity studies is now a new thing that's emerged through Robert Chapman and his group in the UK, critical autism studies through sort of Nick Walker and Remy Urgo and others. So there's a ton of potential in saying that diversity in the way our bodies and minds work is normal, just like biodiversity. And, you know, we need to shift the way in which we understand and, you know, practice in health and education and other arenas, the way in which we understand the full range of diversity and human diversity. So I think that that's a really strong positive. I also have hesitations. So one is that it can essentialize. So when I say that, and it kind of can reduce a person. So when I say essentialize, I mean, you know, drawing a straight line between between kind of brains and world. So it can, that can kind of evacuate or take away the social context in a problematic way, where you can, you know, and essentializing has been used to say, oh, well, mothers are only good for, you know, having babies. So it does have that risk, as well as there's kind of this phenomenon happening around neurodiversity light, which, you know, is kind of losing its connection to really critical self-advocacy kinds of actions and thinking. And everybody gets really excited about it, which is really wonderful, but nothing changes. Neurodiversity is also not new. So the more I work alongside Indigenous communities, you know, it's that this kind of diversity has been recognized and known and valued in many Indigenous communities. And I don't want to homogenize Indigenous community at all. So, but, you know, in the Maori communities I'm working with, in the, you know, different sort of Indigenous organizations that I'm working with. So it's not new. So it gets kind of taken up as new. And it's kind of new old, I guess, as Carla Rice might say.
Is there anything else you think it's important to share with people about your work?
I would like to share that the most important voices to me, even though I write about mothering, are autistic self-advocates and those who are, you know, leading sort of research and scholarship. So that's one thing. The other thing is that the journey of parents, and particularly those in mother roles, needs to also be heard. So those are parallel sites of really important knowledge that needs to be lifted up. That's another tension that can often happen, where self-advocates don't really want to hear from parents and mothers, and understandably, but, you know, I just appreciate this opportunity to talk about the book and to kind of elevate both. So maybe I'll just end there.
Patty Douglas, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thanks so much for having me. It was lovely to meet you.
Patty Douglas is author of the book, Unmothering Autism. That's all the time we have for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.